I was driving on the Gene Snyder this week, and a truck passed me by, and on the back, there was a banner, and it had this phrase, hashtag share your spare, and it was a plea from a mom for her daughter to get a kidney. And I couldn't help but wonder what the fuller story was behind that banner. What was this daughter going through that her mom went through the effort and the cost to cover the back of a semi with a message that said, my daughter needs a transplant? But when you love somebody, the lengths you'll go through, right, to make them be well. Of course, Jesus knew this really well because people came to him nonstop to be well. People brought their friends, their family, their children, themselves to Jesus because they knew he could make them well. We see this in the Gospel of Mark chapter 5, where a synagogue leader, Jairus, comes to Jesus and he's desperate for his daughter, his 12-year-old daughter who's on her deathbed. Jesus, if you'll just come, she'll be made well. She can be raised up from her deathbed. Jairus' daughter ends up dying before Jesus gets there, but Jesus, being Jesus, goes anyway, and he raises her from death back to life. And the reason he doesn't make it in time is because he gets interrupted, and another ministry opportunity presents itself. And I don't know about you, but isn't it interesting how often life happens in the interruptions? So this morning, we want to spend some time looking at this particular interruption in the life of Jesus. It's Mark chapter 5, and we're going to start in verse 25. And a woman was there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years. She had suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors and had spent all she had. Yet instead of getting better, she had only gotten worse. When she heard about Jesus, she came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak because she thought, if I just touch his clothes, I will be healed. Immediately, her bleeding stopped, and she felt in her body that she was freed from her suffering. At once, Jesus realized that power had gone out from him. He turned around in the crowd and asked, who touched my clothes? You see the people crowding against you, his disciples answered, and yet you ask, who touched me? But Jesus kept looking around to see who had done it. What must life have been like for this woman? 12 years, Mark said, she had with much suffering. 12 years of spending all she had in a desperate attempt to get well. And not only did she not get better, she got worse. One commentary points out that neither wealth, nor medicine, nor religion had been any help to her. You might call those the big three, right? Money and medicine and faith are the big three that people turn to find meaning and purpose and hope in life, right? And she didn't find any help in any of those three. And I wonder this morning if there are any of us here who have turned at least one of those big three, money, medicine, or religion, and have felt it hasn't helped. Maybe it's even gotten worse for you. Lee Warren is a Christian and a brain surgeon, and I found out between services, Doug actually knows him, went to school with him. He works with some of the worst tumors called glioblastomas. He wrote a book about his experiences called I've Seen the End of You. And it's a brutally honest assessment of what he realizes when he looks at a scan or looks at a person's brain and he realizes they, in fact, do have a glioblastoma. This aggressive cancer, he knows, will be the end of them. His medical experience, their money, or whatever faith they have is not likely to make any difference. They are going to die from this tumor. And that's here in 2024. If that's true today, what must it have been like for this woman 2,000 years ago? How desperate must she have been? And not just because of her physical health, even more perhaps because of the fact that because she had this flow of blood, she was considered unclean. And being unclean wasn't ultimately a matter of sanitation as it was separation, where she was excluded from life in the community because of this. It wasn't really about germs, it was about the fact that she was on the verge of life and death, and so she was excluded. She was pushed away from family, from the possibility of motherhood, from relationship and connection. She was pushed away from what can give life. And so, no doubt, She had gone through all these experiences, all these efforts, and somehow she had heard about this man, Jesus, who was making people well and bringing them back into community. So with what I like to think of as a combination of faith and feistiness, she goes beyond custom and norm and what's expected, and she reaches out and she touches Jesus. And immediately, Mark says, immediately she can tell physically in her body that she has been made well. But also immediately, Jesus knows that power has gone out from him, and he stops the hustle and bustle, and he says, "Who touched me?" And can't you just hear the disciples laugh? "Who touched you?" "Jesus, you're like a movie star who shows up at the mall. You're like a teacher of preschoolers in a room full of just young kids. Who's not touching you?" But of course, there's a difference between reaching out to touch someone because they're important and reaching out to touch someone because they give life. So Jesus turns and he looks intently to see who's done this. He's not just scanning the crowd, he's looking with a purpose. Jesus wants to find this person. We see something similar in Mark chapter 3, just a couple chapters earlier, where Jesus is doing his ministry, he's teaching and he's healing, and his mom and his brother show up. And they're not really sure what's going on. This Jesus that they've known for 30 years, and he's acting like this, he's doing this, he's talking like this, this just isn't what they expect. It's time for Jesus to just come home. And so Jesus asks this really strange question in Mark chapter 3, verse 33. "Who are my mother and my brothers?" And looking around at those who sat around him, he said, "Here are my mother and my brothers." Man, I sure hope it wasn't Mother's Day, because Jesus basically looks at his family and he says, "I'm not really looking for biology here, I'm looking for theology. I want a family rooted in the will of God." He's apparently so locked in on this fact, he overlooks his sweet mother Mary, he overlooks the religious leaders who everyone else was looking to, and he looks for this isolated, unclean woman to bring her back through her desperate faith. Now, when I look at this woman, what I see is someone whose faith is not fully formed. I don't know that she knows a whole lot, but she knows just enough to press forward for just a piece of Jesus. But of course, that piece leads her to the whole, and that whole leads her to become whole in him. And I don't know about you, but to me, this is an encouraging reminder. I don't have to have all the answers. I don't have to understand everything about Jesus or faith or church to reach out to him. I do not have to know the whole path to take the first step. You see, faith is recognizing that absolute certainty about anything, frankly, is not how life works. We aren't given the gift of absolute certainty about really anything. For many of us, most of the time, faith is believing just enough to reach out to Jesus right where we are, with whatever we've got. Just like this woman. She doesn't have all the answers, but she does know enough to believe that Jesus just might be the way to life. And so she acts on what little belief she has. And while her physical healing is good news, I think what happens after that, after the physical healing, when Jesus finds her in the crowd and she steps forward, that it becomes even more powerful. Let's pick it up again in Mark 5, 32. "But Jesus kept looking around to see who had done it. Then the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell at his feet and, trembling with fear, told him the whole truth. He said to her, 'Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace and be freed from your suffering.'" She steps forward. Really, she falls forward before Jesus with fear and trembling, and she tells the whole truth. Again, another step of faith on her part, because she has no certainty of how Jesus will respond. But what's the very first word out of Jesus' mouth? What does he call her? What's that? What does he call her? He calls her daughter. In just one word, he overcomes 12 years of exclusion and separation as he welcomes her into his family. If anyone's asking the question now in this crowd, who are Jesus' mother and brothers and sisters and sons and daughters? They just got their answer. When a child is born, what do they need? We have been blessed in our church with new babies. The Horns welcomed Catherine. She was here a minute ago. I guess she was a little fussy, so she's back in the nursery. Okay, fair enough. So I won't have her calling, talking back to me. That's all right. So Matthew, you're going to have to step in, all right? Robert, you're going to have to step in for your sister. And then we've got Lena Rommelman back here with like a whole row of Rommelmans back there. And so we've got two new babies. And then if you know Grace and Wes Johnson, who are new to our church within the last year or so, tomorrow I think they're having their baby boy. At least that's the plan, the way they schedule things these days. And so we love welcoming babies into our family. We love welcoming babies into our church. What do babies need? What do they need? They need food. They need someone to change their diapers, right? They need someone to calm their distresses. And they need all those things because they need something. Oh, and AJ's here today, too. I'm sorry. I didn't even mention AJ. AJ's back here, too, as my daughter's holding him, and he seems pretty happy. But what do babies need? They need, before they need the food, well, deeper than the food and the diapers and the distress calls and all that, is they need a place to belong. Right? They need a family. They need to know somewhere that they are loved and cared for, that whatever they're going through in the moment, that someone's going to be there for them, no matter what. They need to be truly known and loved. In other words, what we needed, every single one of us from the first day of life, is what we still need today. No matter how old you are, whether you're one or Ruth, not one anymore, right? A little bit older than that, right? If you're between baby and Ruth, let's say. If you're somewhere between newborn and Ruth Rice, and I mean that really good. I hope I'm not getting in trouble, Ruth. I mean that really positively, because you know I love you. Wherever you are in that spectrum, looking at you too, back here, yep, absolutely. Whatever you need on that spectrum, you just need to still, just like day one, be loved and accepted and have a place to call home. A place where they know you. For example, family is the place where they know your favorite cereal and they know how often you eat it for dinner. They know what makes you smile and they know what makes you cranky. They know when to give you space. Family also knows when to get in your face. Family is a place to belong, to be known, and to be loved. And the beauty of this church, the beauty of any healthy church, is that's exactly what we offer. Now, do we do it perfectly? Of course not. If you've been here long, you know that's not true, right? You know that this church makes mistakes. We can be messy. If you've been here long enough, you've gotten your feelings hurt, right? Someone's hurt you. There's just no doubt about it, because that's what family does. But what church offers is no matter where your family life is like outside of these walls, no matter what your biological family reality is, your theological family is a place where you can truly find home and to be known and to be accepted, and to be loved. I want to give you three quick questions you can ask yourself to kind of just say, is this my family? Is Westport Road my family? And I get when I'm saying this, I'm talking to people that have been here again forever, and people that this is like your first or second week. I get that. But it's a great question, or even if they're watching online, to ask yourself, is my church really my family? First question is, do we know your name? Do we simply know your name? Or are you more or less a nameless person who slips in and slips out? Church, when it's family, is where we know you and you know us. Second question is, do we know your story? Not just your name, but your story. Do we know your stuff? And do you know our stuff? Because here's the third thing that matters, and this is really key. Church is family when we know your stuff and we still love you. We know your stuff and we still love you because we know we have stuff and we are still loved. Everyone needs a place to call home where we are known and we are still loved. One commentator notes that before this woman in our story meets Jesus, she's nameless, she's poor, she's excluded from the synagogue. But Jesus pulls her into the open, out of the shadows, out of isolation, into the healing and restoration and relationship that he alone can give. Jesus calls her front and center and he names her as a daughter and says, "Your faith has healed you." That's how the NIV puts it. Your faith has healed you. Other versions say, your faith has made you well. Or in the classic words of the King James Version, it's made thee whole. All of these words, healed, made well, made whole, they're a way of expressing a word that we more conventionally simply translate as saved. It's the same word as that. like in Romans 10:13. In Romans 10:13, for everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. That's the same word, saved, there, as used here for healed. Or Ephesians 2:8. It's by grace you've been saved through faith. Same word there, saved, as is used in Mark 5, for her being made well. You see, the difference is, for Mark and in the Gospels generally, this word is not used academically, which is not a bad thing, but it's used more practically. It is literally a hands-on word. With Jesus, salvation is literally a hands-on experience. He shows up personally, specifically, in real time, in real touch. And so, as one commentator says, this woman's healing and salvation are deliverance from the enemies of life. Another one says it's rescue from the power of death. You see, her salvation is both deliverance from and deliverance to. Deliverance from sickness to wellness. Deliverance from exclusion to inclusion. Deliverance from isolation to community. Deliverance from death to life. She is now a daughter. She's part of the family. She is welcomed into community where her name and her story are known and she is loved. So what about you? What about you this morning? Where do you need healing? Where do you need salvation? Where do you need to reach out and touch Jesus? You know, for many of us, when we think of healing, for us, that picture is the picture of just getting better, right? A kidney transplant, cancer in remission, broken bones healed, COVID clobbered, surgery successful, mental health challenges overcome. But what happens when healing for you and me doesn't look like healing for this woman? What happens when Alzheimer's doesn't go away, or chronic pain, or anxiety, or the undeniable reality that with life comes affliction, and if you live enough of life, you will get afflicted? Philip Yancey writes about Dr. Paul Brand, who spent his medical missionary career working among folks who had leprosy. And despite the fact that leprosy is not as contagious as most people fear, and that most people have an immunity to it naturally, it's always brought on a sense of dread when people hear about someone who has leprosy. And so among the worst effects of leprosy, both in Jesus' day and ours, even though the disease is different now, is isolation. Dr. Brand says it's a devastatingly lonely disease. In many countries, its victims are kicked out of their homes, rejected by the community, and sometimes forced to live outdoors by a pile of rocks or in a cave. They lose contact with other humans. Once, Brand was examining the hands of a young man who had leprosy, trying to explain to him the progress of his disease could be halted, that perhaps he might even be able to use his affected hand again. And Brand expected, by telling the man this news, that he would smile in response at this good news, but instead, the patient began to shake with muffled sobs. "Have I said something wrong?" Brand asked his assistant. "Did he misunderstand me?" "No," she told him. "It's just that he's crying because you put your hand on his shoulder. No one has touched him for many years." Friends, this is what we offer the world. This is the healing and salvation that we share with every hungry or hurting person, with every discouraged or difficult person, whether they are lonely, angry, independent, or codependent. With all who are faithless, aimless, and hopeless, we can offer the touch of Jesus, the warmth of his welcome, the healing of his embrace, as we live out our calling to be the hands and the feet and the heart of Jesus. When we have been touched by the love of Jesus, we then turn and offer it to others. That's the healing that we first can give them. You see, we can't fix all of the world's wounds and scars, its sicknesses and sorrows. We're not going to be able to solve all their problems, answer all their questions. But what we do offer others is what we ourselves have received, the touch of Jesus. Jesus, who is still looking for brothers and sisters and sons and daughters. Three times in the Corinthian letters, Paul tells us that we are the temple of God. And in one of those, he says it this way, 2 Corinthians chapter 6. What agreement is there between the temple of God and idols? For we are the temple of the living God. As God has said, I will live with them and walk among them, and I will be their God, and they will be my people. Therefore, come out from them and be separate, says the Lord. Touch no unclean thing, and I will receive you. And I will be a father to you, and you will be my sons and daughters, says the Lord Almighty. This temple of God, the physical, literal temple in Jerusalem, was the location where God and people would meet. It was the focus of that place. And this woman could not enter it because of her uncleanness. And even if she had been clean, she would not have been able to go as far in as men could go. So the temple for this woman meant exclusion. And what is Paul saying here? He's saying that we don't need a physical location anymore because this is earth-shattering news. Even if you've been in church forever, this is crazy. We are the temple of God. We don't go to a physical location. We don't need this building. It's great to have it. We love this place, but this is not the church. We are. Everyone who has been touched by the living presence of Jesus and been healed by him in our hearts and in our lives, we then become his living presence, and this woman is on the front lines of that. She is a part of the temple of God. Only Jesus can do that. This is the healing he offered her, and this is what he still offers us today. His presence among us, bringing us together, calling us home, making us family, making us sons and daughters. So before I close, I want to get real practical what I think this means for us. And some of this will apply to some of you. Maybe none of this will apply to you, but I want to think about where you are in life and what it means about to experience the touch of Jesus. Because I think it means that the doctor may say to you, we can treat this, you're going to defeat this. Or the doctor may say to you, you're going to have to learn to live with this. Or the doctor might say, it's time to get your affairs in order. Whatever the doctor says, you know that ultimately you will be okay, big picture okay, because you are a son or daughter of Jesus. This means that when your boss calls you in the office and says, congratulations, you're getting a promotion, or, I'm sorry, we're going to have to let you go, it doesn't change your status that you're a part of the family of God. This means whether you have a great biological family that is there for you every day and every step of the way, or you're in a family where you feel overlooked and on the edges, or just the word family itself makes you think of dysfunction and trauma, whatever your biological family has looked like, here and in the church of God, you are in a family. There's a place for you here. And when you don't feel like you matter, when you feel out of place or out of steam or out of answers or out of hope, Jesus invites you to reach out to him. So whatever your questions or your doubts, your hurts or your hang-ups, your sins or your struggles, your healing is found in your continuing to reach out and hold on to Jesus. His final words to this woman in Mark 5:34 are, go into peace and be well from your affliction. Literally, go into peace. I love that. He's releasing her into a life of peace. She is no longer defined by her past, nor will she be defined by whatever maladies come along in the next step of her life. She is no longer now defined by her identity that the world has put on her, nameless, poor, excluded, unclean. That's not her anymore. She is now living in the abiding peace of Jesus, and it is bigger than anything she has faced or anything she will face. Because ultimately, the peace of Jesus is not that you were defined by your maladies, your mistakes, or your messes. It's not even about the fact that they might all go away. They may not. No, the healing place is where you go from being unclean to clean. You go from being nameless to being named. It's where you go from not having a family to being a part of a family that loves you, that calls you son or daughter because of Jesus, that includes you. You go from being a place on the outside to a place on the inside, because Jesus has looked at each one of us and has said, I call you son, I call you daughter.